Hello and welcome to the first episode in our special series of podcasts for Worming Week in partnership with Agria. Across this week, we are going to be showing loads of content all about how we can best support our horses when it comes to parasites, or as we quite often just say, worming. Having the right parasite testing and treatment program in place is an important part of keeping our horses healthy and also helps to protect the national herd. Today, we're going to explore the different parasite tests that you can do with your horse and what factors need to be considered when putting together a program that suits the individual's needs. Joining me to discuss this is Tim Mayer. He is a partner at Bell Equine Veterinary Clinic and an RCVS recognised specialist in equine internal medicine and soft tissue surgery. Tim sits on the council for the British Equine Veterinary Association and is involved in CANTA, a collaborative industry-led organisation dedicated to tackling anthelmintic resistance. Welcome, Tim.
Hello, Rachel. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Thank you very much for joining us. So let's kick this off then. When we're talking about the types of parasites that you might find in our horses that we're trying to prevent here, what actually are they and what impact can they have on the health of our horses?
Yep. So there are a number of different types of worms and parasites that horses can get, some of which are important and can cause serious disease, some of which are not. So I'll just briefly run through these different types of parasites. I'm going to mention, I think, 9 different types of parasites. As I say, some of them are really important and some of them are really not important. So the first one to discuss is Strongyloides westeri, or threadworms. This is a very common parasite in foals, young foals, usually soon after birth, but it's very rarely associated with disease. When they do cause disease, it's usually associated with diarrhea and colitis. But in most cases, apart from the odd stud where there's an issue, you do not need to worry about Strongyloides westeri in foals. The next one is Ascarids. This is another worm that affects foals. So these are Parascaris species, generally known as Ascarids. These are very common in foals, especially on stud farms, and it can infect foals up to about 7 or 8 months of age. When they get past that age, they develop an immunity. So adult horses and older weanings and older horses generally don't suffer with Ascarids, whereas younger foals do. As they get older, the Ascarids become less common and the small red worm or scythostomins become much more important. And we'll talk about those. If young foals do get serious infections with Ascarids, it can cause respiratory disease and poor condition due to the larvae of the worm that migrates through the lungs and the liver of the foal. The most important and serious disease caused by Ascarids is an intestinal impaction, where a large number of Ascarids, especially if they're given a worming dose, an anthelmintic drug that kills them, they can all die rapidly, and then they get form a blockage in the intestine. And that causes serious colic in foals. It is a nasty disease, and it is very difficult to treat when it does happen. It generally requires surgery, but even with surgery, there's quite a high mortality rate. So we should be aiming to try and prevent this from happening. The eggs of Ascarids are very resistant and very resilient, and they persist on the pasture for long periods of time. And that is a problem, so that if Ascarid eggs are passed on to the pasture, they can stay on that pasture till the next year and then infect the next crop of foals in the following year. So pasture hygiene, cleaning up the pasture, rotating pasture and stuff, which I think we'll talk about later, is really important. When we talk about worming drugs, there are 3 main classes of worming drugs, or anthelmintics is their proper name. These are the benzimidazoles, the pyrimidines, and the macrocyclic lactones. So we only have those 3 main groups of worming drugs. And the problem with Ascarids is that they are developing resistance to these drugs. So there is widespread resistance to the macrocyclic lactones. That includes things like ivermectin and moxidectin. And this is a real problem. So if the foal becomes infected with these Ascarids, you obviously need to treat them with a drug that works. And if we have resistance, then it means those drugs potentially don't work. So foals need to be treated usually at 2 to 3 months of age with a drug, hopefully, that will kill them. A worm egg count at that point isn't going to be helpful because the ascrids at that age will all be larvae and they aren't producing eggs. So you can't actually test for them. So you need to treat these foals automatically rather than relying on a worm egg count at that age. And then as you go forwards, we'll talk about later, it's important to monitor the worm egg counts. So that's the second type of parasite. The third one, and one that's probably most common, are the small redworm or sarthostomins. These are very common and ubiquitous in all horses, all grazing horses. And the problem with the small redworms is that the larval stages, when a horse becomes infected by grazing pasture, where the infective larvae are sitting and they then ingest those larvae, those larvae burrow into the intestinal wall. And they can actually become inhibited at that point in the wall of the large intestine, especially in young horses, usually in the age of 1 to 5 years. And so those young horses, if they're picking up lots of small redworm, they can accumulate many thousands of larvae in the wall of the intestine. And as I say, those larvae can then become inhibited and undergo a state a bit like hibernation. Then at some point, and we don't really know why, but at some point, they may all decide to continue their migration at the same time. So you get thousands upon thousands of larvae then burrowing back through the intestinal wall into the gut, into the inside of the gut, into the lumen. But as they do so, they cause serious damage to that intestinal wall. That causes severe colitis or inflammation of the intestine. That results in severe diarrhea. Weight loss, rapid weight loss usually, serious diarrhea, edema formation, so swelling of the legs and the body. And this disease, unfortunately, which is most commonly seen in young horses, 1, 2, 3 years of age, this disease has a high mortality rate because of the severe damage that those worms cause to the intestinal wall. So young horses, as I say, are particularly prone. Also possibly geriatric horses, horses with poor immunity, horses with Cushing's disease or PPID can also become infected with large numbers of these worms as well. The other problem with the small redworms is there's widespread resistance to the benzimidazole group of drugs, and there's increasing resistance to the other groups of drugs as well. And I would just mention that there are no new anthelmintic drugs on the horizon, so we really need to protect the ones that we've got, because if the worms have become resistant to all of them, then we really have no option for treating them. So that's the small redworms. The next group of worms are the large redworms, or Strongylus vulgaris, commonly known as the blood worm. Now this worm used to be very common in the UK, and it causes problems because the larval stages, unlike the small redworms, they actually migrate up through blood vessels of the gut and they cause damage to the blood supply to the intestine, and that can result in severe colic and or peritonitis. Since we started using anthelmintic drugs commonly back in the 60s, the large redworms have become very rare because we basically wiped them out. But there is a problem that if we're now trying to reduce the use of these drugs because we want to stop the resistance happening, especially in the small redworms, which means there's a potential for these large redworms to start coming back. And in some parts of the world where the use of these anthelmintic drugs is legally restricted and they're not commonly used, they are seeing the reappearance of the large redworm. The other important worm that most horses, all types of horses can get, is tapeworms. So the common one in this country is called Anoplocephala perfoliata. Horses become infected because they graze and they eat infected mites on the pasture. These are called oribatid mites, especially in the summer and the autumn time. Now, tapeworms can affect horses of all ages. So young horses from about 6 months of age become infected, and all horses beyond that are susceptible to being infected with tapeworms. The tapeworms cause damage to the lining of the gut because they basically have suckers which burrow into the lining of the intestine, cause damage to it, and that can lead to colic, certain types of specific types of colic, and also the so-called spasmodic colic. Now, most adult horses don't have big problems with tapeworms, but there are a proportion of horses that which seem to be more susceptible, and there are certain premises where there is a big tapeworm problem, especially on studs, because again, young horses are particularly susceptible. The other types of parasites are less important in terms of causing disease. So pinworms, Oxyuris equi, can infect, again, horses of any age. Most horses carry very low levels and don't have any problem with that. But in certain horses, you get larger numbers, and these can cause irritation to the horses around the back end, making them rub and potentially making them sore, but due to rubbing. And that's because the adult female worms of pinworms actually migrate from the rectum to the anus, where they then lay their eggs on the skin. And that process is very irritating to some horses, and that makes them rub their tails and their backside. And this is a difficult one to deal with, because as soon as horses are infected and they're rubbing their tails on fence posts and walls of stables and stuff, this is where the eggs then can survive for long periods, and they can then be a source of reinfection for those horses. The other types of parasites, well, there's BOTS called Gastrophilus. These are larval stages of a fly. Flies lay their eggs on the hair coat, and the horse then ingests them, and the BOT larvae develop in the stomach, where they don't cause a problem, or very rarely cause a problem. So that's not something we need to worry too much about. We need to be aware that some horses, especially on pastures where there's been co-grazing with cattle or sheep, and pastures that are wet or have marshy ground, there's a risk that they could pick up fluke. Fluke is another, a bit like tapeworms, but they can cause damage in the liver of horses. So in particular areas, especially marshy ground, that can be a problem. And then the last one is lungworm or Dictyocolus. This is a parasite predominantly of donkeys. Horses don't carry large numbers, but if horses are grazing pasture that's been co-grazed by a donkey, then potentially they can pick up lungworm. And the lungworm can migrate in the respiratory tract in the lungs, where they cause a bronchitis and coughing and disease of that nature. So those are the main parasite groups. The important ones in the UK for most people and most horses will be the ascarids, the small red worms, and the tapeworms in particular.
Thank you, Tim. As you say, there's quite a broad range there, but it is those three that we do mainly focus on. And in terms of actually identifying whether or not the horse is carrying a burden of those parasites, there are a number of tests that we can do. Do you want to maybe explain a bit about sort of the ones that we should be doing to test for those?
Yeah, the commonly used one is the fecal egg count, which basically means we're looking to identify the number of eggs being passed out in the droppings in the feces of horses. Those are the eggs that are going to contaminate the pasture, which they may lead to further infection of that horse or other horses grazing that pasture. So this is particularly useful for looking at ascarid eggs and cyathostomin or small redworm eggs. So it's a measure of the potential for that individual horse to contaminate pasture. It doesn't really tell us how many worms that horse has got, because some horses can have lots of worms and have low worm counts, and some horses, vice versa, can have very few worms but actually have high worm counts. It doesn't really matter, but what we really want to know is how potentially damaging and how many eggs are potentially going to contaminate the pasture from that horse. So Basically, we can look for ascrids in foals from about four to 5 months of age. And adult horses and older horses, we're looking for a small redworm or scythostomin eggs every 2 to 3 months during the grazing period. And involving the fecal egg count basically means taking a fresh fecal sample from an individual horse. And it's important to remember that it needs to be fresh. Ideally, you would take a pinch of droppings from one or two or three or four or five even fecal balls and mix them together, because we find that the eggs aren't evenly distributed. So some fecal balls have lots of eggs and some don't. So mixing them together is really a good idea. Put that little sample in a plastic pot or plastic bag. Try and exclude air, because that will slow down the development of the eggs, and then get it to the lab as soon as possible to do the fecal worm egg count. Now, if it's going in the post, that's fine. If there's any delay in getting the sample to the lab, then you can safely store it in the fridge for a day or two. It's better to keep it cold. In warm, hot weather, those eggs will hatch and develop quite quickly. So in the summer heat, especially if it's over about 25 degrees, the eggs will hatch and the larvae will develop very rapidly. That means that the you won't see the eggs on the when you do the examination because they've already hatched. So when that sample gets to the lab, they mix it up and they look at it under the microscope and basically count the number of eggs that horse is pushing out into feces, to give you an idea of how much contamination of the pasture is happening. Now, fecal egg counts are great, as I say, for ascrids and small redworm, totally unreliable for tapeworms, on the other hand. And that's because the tapeworm eggs aren't released all the time. That's very intermittent. So you'll get a period where lots of eggs come out and then you'll have a long period where no eggs. So a negative worm egg count for tapeworm eggs doesn't really tell you anything. If you get a positive count, then it means you have got tapeworms, but a negative count doesn't rule it out. And that's why we use an antibody test for tapeworm. And this can be done either with a blood sample, with a serum sample, or with a saliva sample. And looking for antibodies that the horse is producing in response to it having tapeworms. And there's a great correlation between the number of tapeworms that the horse has got and the level of the antibody response. So by looking at how high that antibody response is, you can get a good indication of how many tapeworms is in the horse. So that's the usual way of determining whether a horse has tapeworm. Now, because it's an antibody test, it means that the antibodies, it's really historic. It's just saying the horse has been exposed to tapeworms. It doesn't tell you that they're potentially necessarily causing a disease. And if you've recently wormed the horse with a drug that is effective against tapeworms, they'll still have a high antibody T level because it takes several months for that antibody to drop down after all the tapeworms have been eliminated. So you need to remember that. For pinworms, we use a sellotape test commonly. So this basically means taking a little bit of sellotape, sticking on the backside of the horse and then putting it on a slide. And in the lab, you look under the microscope to look for the pinworm eggs. Then the only other thing to mention is a smooth redworm blood test. This can be really useful in certain indications, certain situations. It's another antibody test. So it gives you an idea of how many small redworm is in the horse. Now, this does not distinguish between larval stages and adult stages of small redworm. So it's a whole redworm test, if you like. It's not specific for larval stages and it's not specific for adult stages. But it can be a useful test to use in certain situations. For example, in the autumn time, when we traditionally have been treating horses with moxidectin, the drug that we think is going to kill the larval stages of small redworms in the intestine. Nowadays, we're promoting what's called a risk assessment to try and decide what the risk for that individual horse or that pasture is. And only treating horses that are high risk, and the horses that are low risk and are really not likely to be contaminating the pasture, we don't want to treat them. We can use a small red worm blood test to help make that decision in low risk horses. So if you've got a low risk horse and you're kind of used to treating this horse every year with moxidectin, and your advisor, your vet or your SQP says it doesn't need treating, then you can use a small red worm blood test to really prove that, and show that it's got a low level of red worm and therefore doesn't need treating. And we're trying to reduce the use of this moxidectin drug, and this is one way of achieving that. We can also use this test in other situations, especially in disease situations or conditions of poor performance or poor condition where you think you may have a red worm problem, but your fecal egg count may be low, but as I say, that doesn't mean the horse hasn't got lots of red worm. So using the small red worm blood test could be a really useful adjunct to your diagnosis in that sort of case. I think that covers all the tests.
I think it does, and certainly the key ones. And obviously the blood tests and things you will have to work on with your vet, but certainly the fecal worm egg count kits and saliva tapeworm tests you can get over the counter at a lot of sort of your tack shops and things like that, and you can work with the SQP there to make sure you're buying the right test. You mentioned there obviously certain sort of times of the year, obviously the fact that certainly traditionally the way we used to do things when we were treating horses a lot more routinely at certain times of the year. Should we be doing the test at certain points in the year, or is it just kind of a rolling calendar? Because you also mentioned the grazing period in there as well. So when would that be?
It depends on the circumstances. Things like the age of the horse, the risk assessment that you should be doing on an annual basis, how well the pasture is managed, what the access to pasture is. So if the horse is grazing, obviously it's going to pick up potentially more small red worm parasites than a horse that's got really limited access to grazing. Whether the horse is on its own or grazing with others, all of these things kind of play a role in deciding the best time to do fecal egg counts, and how often to do them. So for foals, age is a really important thing to consider, because ascarids are a big problem in foals. So the age rather than the time of year is the most important thing. As I said before, we should be worming foals routinely at 2 to 3 months of age. And thereafter, at sort of 5 months, 6 months, you should be doing worming count every 2 to 3 months to determine how many eggs are coming out from ascarids, but also determine when the small red worms are starting to appear, because that will determine what worming or anthelmintic drug you need to use. Because as I say, there is resistance problems to both of those parasites, especially ascarids and the macrocyclic leptones. In adult horses, generally speaking, a worming count every 2 to 3 months while that horse is over the grazing period to monitor the amount of eggs that it's shedding onto the pasture. And again, pasture management is really important. We can't rely on drugs because of this rapidly growing resistance. And as I say, there's no new drugs on the horizon. And remember, of course, that lots of horses now will be grazing during the winter as well. So we ought to be thinking about doing worm egg count during the winter as well. Now, worm transmission tends to be much slower in the winter, so we might not need to do it as frequently during the colder months. But if the horse is grazing pasture during the winter, then it is still worth doing a worm egg count to check. And with climate change and the sort of general warming temperatures, this is likely becoming more and more important. In terms of tapeworms, in young horses and on studs, you're likely to want to test these animals twice a year. So in the spring and the autumn, classically. Because, as I say, it's an antibody test and it takes time for those antibody levels to follow after treatment, you need to bear that in mind. So there's no point in repeating a tapeworm test in a month or two. It will still be high. But if you repeat it in 6 months and it's still high, then that suggests that that animal has become reinfected during that period, and there's a problem on that pasture, on that premises. And this is becoming a serious problem on some studs, where they're having high levels of tapeworms despite treating them regularly. And it's all to do with the number of tapeworms on the pastures and the numbers of oribatid mites on the pastures. Now, oribatid mites tend to increase in numbers during the summer, during the warmer period. So for an average horse out there, doing a tapeworm saliva or blood test, it's probably worth doing it in the spring. So that if that horse has got high tapeworm burden and is potentially passing lots of eggs out, you try and kill those tapeworms before it goes out and starts infecting growing numbers of oribatid mites. Most adult general horses have low tapeworm levels, so once a year testing is probably right. But on some premises, on some individual horses, if you have high levels, so if your tapeworm test is high on one occasion, it's probably worth repeating that in 6 months. So in other words, for high risk situations, then twice a year, spring and autumn is the best time to do it. But for other horses where they're low risk and they have low count, low antibody levels, then once a year should be fine. And the small red worm blood tests are generally done in the autumn period, as say, to help you with that decision whether or not to use moxidectin.
I suppose ultimately it's we are moving to a far more individualized program for our horses. It is not this prescribed one that we had for a number of years.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you mentioned in there about sort of risk assessment and things, and I believe Cantor's got quite a good matrix to help you work out where your horse sits on that.
Yes.
And we will we'll put a link to that in the description for this podcast episode, and also share it on our social media as well, because it is definitely worth having a look at. It's a very useful tool. Now, one test we haven't talked about that can be useful for people is an egg reduction test.
Yeah.
What are one of those and how do they work?
So the egg reduction test is specifically designed to identify anthelmintic resistance in a horse or in a herd of horses on a particular premises or a particular pasture. And it's specifically looking at either ascarids, but more likely to the small cyathostomes, that's small redworms or cyathostomes. So basically what it involves is doing a worm egg count as usual. There are various ways of doing the worm egg count. We can get into detail of that, but you need to use a fairly sensitive technique with a what they call a low multiplication factor. And this test is best done as a group of horses if there's a group grazing a pasture, but it can be done on an individual horse basis as well. So you take your worm egg count on this just before you worm that horse with your chosen anthelmintic or worming drug. So as I say, there are only three classes of anthelmintic drugs. So on the first day, you do a worm egg count and then you treat the horse. It's important that you treat the horse with the right amount of drug, and that depends on the weight of the horse. So assessing the weight of the horse, either you visually or using a weigh tape, is really important so that you make sure that you're giving the right amount of drug. You then wait 14 days and you take another fecal egg count, so another fecal sample, and then you look at and do a worm egg count. So what if these wormers are working well and doing what they should do in killing the small cyathostome larvae, you would expect the worm egg count to reduce on the second occasion by at least 90% compared to the first worm egg count. If there's resistance, then it won't be working as well, in which case the reduction will be much less than 90%. And it could even be negative. You could have an increase on the second count if there's complete resistance. So it's the most effective way of identifying anthelmintic resistance in that situation, on that premises, in that herd of horses or the horse or single horse even that's on a pasture. So the way you can do it for ascarids and cyathostomins, as I mentioned, the tapeworm tests are really difficult to use. You can't use a fecal egg count reduction test reliably in tapeworms. However, if you do you can try it. So if you have lots of tapeworms and the horse is producing eggs, you may, especially in a group of horses, you can, if you find lots of eggs on the second sample, it means that that drug you use wasn't effective at treating tapeworms. But apart from that, there's no easy way of determining resistance in tapeworms.
And resistance is something that we're going to look at a little bit more closely in the next podcast this week. So do tune in to that. It's a very important topic. So definitely do give it a listen. You mentioned near the start of the podcast, Tim, about management and how important that is in managing the transmission of parasites and hopefully obviously reducing that transmission. What are some of the steps that owners can take on their yards to try and do this?
Yeah, so pasture management is absolutely vital. It's essential. As I say, we can't rely on the drugs to treat the parasites in horses anymore. We've got to use a combination of pasture management plus drugs, and we're trying to reduce the use of drugs. So as we mentioned with ascrids in foals, we know those eggs are very resilient and they'll live on pasture from year to year. So ideally, you wouldn't graze a foals on the same pasture every year, because you're going to then just simply pass ascrids from one crop to the next crop, or one foal to the next foal. That's great. So you want so-called clean pasture, that is pasture that's been rested sufficiently so that all the eggs and the larvae have died off by the time you start grazing it again. For general horses and for all adult horses, hoof picking is the most important thing that you can probably do. So we're aiming to pick up the feces and remove the eggs and larvae before they can become established on the pasture. And that means hoof picking at least once a week, all year round. When I say all year, it's whenever that pasture's been grazed, but that may be all year round. In warm weather, in hot weather, because the transmission of parasites is so much faster, then you should be poop picking at least twice a week. And we're aiming to basically, as I say, remove those eggs and larvae so that they don't establish on the pasture, and because they migrate onto the grass and then the horse was going to graze that grass. When you take the poo off, most people will put it onto a muck heap. It's important that muck heap is well away from that pasture, because the larvae can migrate from a muck heap back onto the pasture if you're not careful. So it needs to be several meters away, and certainly not in the same pasture as where you're doing the poo picking. And the heat generated in muck heap but by composting will actually kill those eggs and larvae off, so that's really important. The other thing to try and do is to rest pastures. So what you're trying to do is to allow the eggs and larvae that are on that pasture die off naturally, because they can't survive forever without infecting a horse. The problem is especially for the ascrids and for the small redworms, that takes many months for those larvae to die off, and ideally it should be at least 12 months, which is not very practical in many situations. So the recommendation for generally speaking for the small redworm is to rest the pasture at least from the end of the one grazing period, so if that may be in the autumn, way right round to the middle of the next grazing period, so that's the middle of the summer the following year, to give that a chance for those larvae to die off. Another thing you can do is co-graze or alternate graze with ruminants, with cattle or sheep, because there are no important parasites that can infect both ruminants and horses. So ruminants can kind of hoover up the horse parasites and vice versa. Just remembering that the only parasite that can potentially be a problem is fluke. Especially on wet ground, because in an intermediate host, just like tapeworms, which are actually snails that live in the wet ground, So fluke is a thing to remember on those situations where there's co-grazing with cattle and sheep. Other things to think about, well, quarantine of new arrivals onto a yard. In many situations, new horses arriving on a ride, you don't really know what the parasite control history has been. So you don't really know whether there's been good control on that individual horse, whether that horse could be infected with lots of parasites, which will then contaminate your pastures unless you're careful. And of course, the big worry is that the horse, new horse coming in, could be infected with resistant parasites. And that's the last thing you want to introduce onto your pasture. So these horses need to be quarantined. And generally, we recommend at least 3 weeks for a quarantine period for general biosecurity to prevent other viral infections and other things like strangles. At the same time, we need to test these horses so we can do a fecal worm egg count. If you potentially could do a fecal egg reduction test, potentially do a small redworm blood test and the tapeworm test to identify what the risk is of introducing that horse onto your pastures. And say we're beware of particularly of introducing resistant parasites.
Thank you. So quite simple steps there. It's just
yes,
doing them regularly and carrying that, being careful and consistent. Yeah. As we've talked about quite a lot of different things in this conversation, as we are drawing to the end, are there any particular points that you think it's really key to point out, maybe that we haven't discussed yet?
I don't think the key points are, in terms of parasite control, do a risk assessment. Work with your SQP or your vet to work out what the risks are for individual horses or groups of horses, because that really determines how much you need to worry about using anthelmintic worming drugs. And say we're constantly looking at ways to try and reduce the use of these drugs, because every time we give a horse a wormer, we're potentially stimulating resistance. Resistance is a natural phenomenon. It's, you know, genetic changes happen all the time, just like they do with antibiotics as well. So risk assessment, doing regular testing, both for the worm egg count and the tapeworm testing, and identifying high-risk horses and only treating them and not treating the other horses. I guess that's the most important thing. The pasture management is an important component of the risk assessment, and that's where poo picking is probably the most important, useful thing you can do.
Thanks, Tim. And I'm guessing, you know, if you want to find a bit more, if you need some support in this area, you want to find out a bit more, your vet is probably going to be your first port of call, aren't they?
Yeah, your vet should be able to give you advice. And, you know, a number of veterinary practices have the sort of health plans now that are available, and worming risk assessment and worming advice is usually part of that. SQPs as well, obviously, are trained and should be able to advise you about using drugs. But as I say, we're trying to reduce the use of drugs. So the risk assessment, talking to your vet, talking to your SQP, looking on the internet, looking at the Canter guidelines. The Canter guidelines are produced by a large group of kind of experts who know various different aspects of parasites. On that group, there are parasitologists, there are vets, there are people from drug industry, people from the labs and so on. So there's a general big pool of knowledge trying to come together with some sensible guidelines that will apply to in all situations to help people to manage horses, but in particular managing the parasites that those horses will get. And parasites, all horses will get parasites. We're not trying to eliminate parasites, we're just trying to keep them to a low level and prevent the buildup of parasites and the buildup of resistant parasites that then cause disease.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point there, actually, the fact that ultimately parasites are part of nature, it's part of life, it's just keeping them at a manageable level and avoiding those health problems that we talked about right at the top of the podcast. And I'm glad you pointed out those Canter guidelines, because they are a really, really useful resource. Again, we will signpost you to those, so have a read. It's broken down nicely into sections so you can work your way through it, but it is a really useful resource. this has been the first, as I say, of our podcast this week for Worming Week. Later in the week, we will be looking a bit more about the resistance and the risk management side of things. And we will be ending the week looking at the environmental impact, both on a local and wider level, of using the amphotericin drugs that we have discussed today. So hopefully you can join us and also keep an eye on our social media, where we will be sharing lots more resources as well. So thank you very much, Tim, for giving up your time to speak to us today.
Welcome.
And thank you to everyone who's been listening as well. We hope you will join us for the rest of Worming Week. We will see you again soon.